So with that, we call the first case of the day, and that's United States of America versus Christopher O'Quinn and two or three others. And Mr. Averley, we'll hear from you representing Mr.
Zavalon.
Zavalon. Okay. Give it your best.
Yes, sir. Two of the issues that my client, Nick Zavalon, has raised depend on the following facts. Although Mr. Zavalon met Arthur Basaldúa in prison and they became friends, and although Mr. Basaldúa in 2006 moved in with my client when he got out of jail, the 14-month investigation by the FBI that ended in May 2007 left very little to connect my client to Mr. Zafalam's activities. And this is despite telephone interceptions and wired CI, and you had video surveillance and controlled purchases at the house that the two men shared. On the other hand, you had mail intercepts in which Mr. Basaldúa chides my client for preferring legitimate employment. This is all consistent with my client's claim and supported by statements of other co-conspirators and his witnesses that he had declined to participate in Mr. Basaldúa's activities and that he actually moved out from that house and then out of the state in part to get away from him and his criminality. Now, to be sure, by the time of trial, there were co-conspirators inspired by the enticement of a lower sentence who did give testimony implicating Mr. Zafalam in the charged conspiracy. Much of that testimony was ambiguous. All of it was uncorroborated, and because none of it was corroborable. But we're not saying that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law under Jackson, but what we are saying is that given that this evidence was very far from overwhelming and given that it was contradicted, there was plenty of opportunity for this jury to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt, or to conclude that the government failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt of my client's connection with Basaldúa's activities. The problem in this case occurs because of what we believe was a remarkable thing the government did that crippled the jury's ability to fairly assess this evidence. And what they did was reflected in one of the 12 overt acts in this charged conspiracy in which they claim that in 2002, the beginning of 2002, Mr. Zafalam possessed over a kilogram of methamphetamine, which is by far more methamphetamine than all the others discussed at trial. Unlike the other 11 overt acts or any of the other substantive counts in this case, this is the only one that involved Mr. Zafalam, and it's the only overt act in which the conduct occurred did not happen in 2006 and 2007. What makes why we think this is remarkable is that after the government presents all of its evidence on this 2002 conduct at the trial, we come to learn that this 2002 conduct has absolutely nothing to do with the charged conspiracy. What we learn is that the police raided his home and found out that he was making methamphetamine in a lab that he had in his shed in the backyard. He wasn't carrying out the stated objective of transporting methamphetamine from California into Louisiana using stolen cars, etc. There's no mention of who, if anyone, he was involved with in 2002. And we know that Mr. Basaldúa, the ringleader of this conspiracy, was not involved at this time because...
But I mean, any sort of hanged by his own rope, when he said that he was continuing this conspiracy of 19 dragons to control South Louisiana's meth market?
No, for two reasons. One is what you're talking about is the testimony of one of these rewarded co-conspirators. I mean, we're not saying that there's no evidence, but we are saying that, you know, you have to... The jury's got to believe this guy, and there's plenty of reason not to believe it. But the other reason is it may have been his intent. We don't believe that it is. But even if it was his intent to get out of jail and start dealing meth, that's not the same conspiracy.
I thought he said it was the continuing. I thought I mean, at least as I understood it from the briefs, the implication was that he's going to continue this same enterprise once he gets out of jail and complete the conspiracy that he begun before he actually was arrested and sentenced in state charge.
Well, again, one position we have on that is that he may have had that intent, he may have even said that, but you've got to have somebody with whom to conspire. And he sits in jail for several years. Who's he been conspiring with during that time? But the other thing is, and if you read the reply brief, you will...
How do you pronounce his name? Not Valdici, but what is his name?
Basaldua.
Batabula?
Basaldua.
Batabula.
Forgot where I was. Yes. The other reason, if you read the reply brief, you will see that the whole contention that he even gave that testimony is dubious at best. In fact, as I point out in the reply brief, Mr. Fonchita, this is the one who talked about the 19 dragons, is asked point blank, did he tell you, after he went to jail, did he say anything about what he intended to do when he got out? And he said no. This argument that the government makes that he said he was going to continue the fifth year of his five-year plan is apparently in reference to the matters he was discussing outside of jail before he went to jail. It's ambiguous, but that last comment, did he say anything what he was going to do when he got out of jail? And he said no. I think you have to just rely on that because... it's the best indication of what this man meant. But again, you need to have someone with whom to conspire, and during the time he was in prison, there was nobody. And now our argument is because the 2002 conduct was not part of the charge conspiracy, you have a variance between the proof and the indictment. And that variance is material because of the enormous disparity you have between the proof offered on the conspiracy and the proof, which is undisputed, that he committed the 2002 act. And finally, because the jury could not have found him guilty under the 2002 conduct because of the statute of limitations, under the joinder analysis, which is used to determine prejudice for fatal variance, it's clear the court would have had to grant a motion to sever had the government charged this separately.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Avila. Ardenay? Ms. Ardenay. Did I get your name pronounced correctly?
Yes, sir. Ardenay.
Ardenay. You know, you're representing...
Mr. Duck Pham.
Pham?
Yes, sir. Mr. Pham was indicted on four counts, one for conspiracy and intent, agreed to possess and intent distribute, and then three other counts for alleged acts for doing count one from communication facility. But the important facts of this appeal do not stem from that indictment. The important facts stem from a detention which occurred on January 2007. Pham and three others went to retrieve a vehicle from the police impound yard. When they got there, the police in California believed that vehicle had been stolen, so they were there waiting for Pham and the others when they got there, they did detain Pham and the other passengers of the vehicle. When the police searched the vehicle, they found contraband in the vehicle, both
Did
drugs.
Did Pham ever come to Louisiana?
Sir?
Did he ever come to Louisiana? Pham?
No, sir.
Okay.
They found drugs as well as a gun in the vehicle. So the issue of this appeal stems from that detention, things that were found in that vehicle. Now, Pham was never charged with any crimes. He was never indicted from the facts of that detention. That detention came into play during the sentencing. The issue was Mr. Pham in possession of that gun and the amount of drugs found in the vehicle. The problem is that the information from that January stop was brought before the jury, but none of that information, the jury was not allowed to make any determinations on that stop. Instead, the judge, not the trier of fact, determined whether Mr. Pham was in possession of the contraband. He took that issue away from the jury. And then the second issue was the amount of drugs found in the vehicle. The trial counsel for Mr. Pham did not offer any objections as to the amount of drugs found. The importance of whether the contraband in the vehicle, both whether he was in possession of the gun and the amount of drugs in the vehicle, affected the amount of his sentence, affected the duration of the length of his sentence. We objected on the basis of the sentence because the judge took away an issue from the trier of fact. Basically, he increased the penalty of the alleged crime without ever having any finding of fact. There were no allegations of the ultimate commission or guilt of a crime by Pham in relation to that stop. According to Apprendi, this information should have been submitted to the jury. The jury should have been allowed to determine whether or not Mr. Pham was in possession of that gun. The question here is not whether the statute regarding the sentence should apply, but the basic issue of whether he was in possession of the gun. The statute dictates that the sentence should be increased if the gun was used in the commission of a crime. So we've got to determine if he was in possession of the gun. Instead of allowing the trier of fact to make that determination, the judge made that determination on his own, and we believe that was in error. We believe that it violated his Sixth Amendment rights.
Well, yeah, but he was sentenced after Booker, right?
Yes, sir.
And he was sentenced within the guideline, I mean, within the statutory maximum.
Yes, sir.
So, I mean, you really don't have much of an argument in the light of the law right now, do you?
It's a tough argument, yes, sir. It does raise an issue because since he was found in possession of that gun by the judge, not the trier of fact, he was no longer eligible for that safety valve. He was no longer eligible for some things that he should have been, and it increased that ultimate penalty, which should never have happened. And so it is a tough argument, but it's one that we felt we should make because of those reasons. The other issue is that the trial counsel never objected to the amount of drugs found in the vehicle at the time of that stop. That information was just put out there, and it was included within the determination of the sentence. And that becomes a significant issue as well as the gun issue because that increased his sentence when it should never have increased the sentence. That should never have happened. And so we have to look at whether or not that Mr. Pham was subjected to an ineffective assistance of counsel because there was never an objection made as to the amount of drugs at that stop. Again, an issue where he was never charged with anything, he was never convicted of anything, but that stop became a very significant factor in the sentencing of Mr. Pham. And so at the time of the sentencing hearing, Mr. Pham's counsel did lay some groundwork and say that this objection should have been made. It was not made. Let's make the objection now. And the trial court at that time dismissed his objections, and he was sentenced. Mr. Pham was sentenced on an increased sentence. The actions of the court and the inactions of his counsel led to Pham receiving that increased sentence, and that's the basis of our appeal. And so we're asking that it either be remanded or that increased sentence be decreased by the 2 years added because of this underlying situation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Burdenlay. Mr. Harville, representing
Mr. Ockwin, Your Honor.
Ockwin.
Your Honor, Mr. Ockwin raised four issues on appeal. However, unless Your Honors have a question on one of the other issues, I will address only the sufficiency of the evidence argument, specifically that the government failed to offer substantial and independent evidence to corroborate the trustworthiness of Mr. Ockwin's confession. The government stated that Mr. Ockwin confessed to 4 points that would be relevant to this appeal and to his conviction. First, that he bought methamphetamine monthly from Mr. Basaldua and that he sold some of this methamphetamine. The problem with the government's argument on this point comes from the testimony of its case agent, Agent Douglas Carr, who testified that there was no evidence independent of Mr. Ockwin's confession to corroborate that he was involved in the methamphetamine conspiracy. In fact, there was no evidence offered at trial that detailed that Mr. Ockwin ever received methamphetamine, that he was ever in the same area when methamphetamine was delivered or distributed. Because of that, the government failed to offer on this first part of his confession substantial or independent evidence to corroborate Mr. Ockwin's confession. The second portion of Mr. Ockwin's confession is that he installed surveillance equipment at Mr. Basadula's house and that he was paid in methamphetamine for doing this installation. Israel Perez, one of the government's witnesses, a witness who had every incentive to help the government's case, to tie Ockwin to this conspiracy testified that Mr. Aquin was paid in cash, not in methamphetamine, again showing that Mr. Aquin's testimony was not trustworthy. So the government's evidence actually did the opposite of what it needed to do. It showed, don't trust Mr. Aquin. He's not telling you the truth in his confession. Mr. Perez, again, in a position that he needed to help the government, if he could truthfully testify to Mr. Aquin's involvement, stated that the cameras were installed not to protect the conspiracy, but to protect Mr. Basadua's family. No evidence from the government that these cameras were put in any manner that would indicate to Mr. Aquin or to anyone else that they were done in anything other than to protect a family, nothing to show they were positioned for counter-surveillance or in any other manner to...
Evidence, it was there evidence that Mr. Aquin, is it Aquin or Aquin?
I pronounce it Aquin, but I don't swear to that.
I mean, I've always kind of wondered about how they pronounce Aquin. Some people call it Aquin. But did he know that drug dealings were going on at that place?
There, to the best of my knowledge, there is no evidence in the record that he knew that drug dealing was going on there. There was a testimony that he bought methamphetamine regularly from Mr. Basadula. That's what he confessed to. But again, Agent Clark,
drug dealer. He knew that the guy was a drug dealer because he had tried to get him out of jail too. Tried to raise bond for him to get out of jail. And
that actually is an argument, and that's the third portion of his confession. But again, if you look at the testimony by the government's witnesses, people who had an incentive to tie Mr. Aquin to this, Melissa Maturin, who was involved in a six-month relationship with Mr. Basadula, says she goes to Mr. Aquin to get bond money from him because he'd been given some rims by Mr. Basadula before Mr. Basadula went to jail. However, Mr. Aquin had no money because he hadn't sold the rims. What this evidence shows is that he received those rims before Mr. Basadula went to jail, before he knew there was a reason for bond. And it shows that Ms. Maturin, not Mr. Aquin, went to raise the money. She doesn't testify that Mr. Aquin said, hey, listen, if you come back in 2 days, I'll get this money. Mr. Aquin doesn't say, hey, come over, I've got money to help bond him out. Let's bond him out to help the meth conspiracy. There's nothing of that. She actually testifies the opposite. It was her leading him and that he did nothing to aid the conspiracy. Further, even if you take the fact that he did raise money, if you find that or find that it was corroborated, there's nothing to show that he raised that money to further the conspiracy. Maybe he just wanted his methamphetamine dealer out of jail, the person who sold him methamphetamine. But again, there's nothing, according to Agent Carr, to tie Mr. Aquin to this conspiracy. That's the government's case agent who admits as much. And that undermines what the government needs to prove in this case. The final hope for the government is in the 105 phone calls between Mr. Aquin and Mr. Basadula. But if you look to U.S. versus Williams, which says what you need to do when you are just using phone calls, the government didn't meet that standard. In Williams, there was testimony by other co-conspirators as to Mr. Williams' involvement in the conspiracy. The government tied the timing of the phone calls to events that furthered the conspiracy. In this case, all you have is a cold record, 105 phone calls between two people. Establishes nothing more than that they knew each other, which is not contested, that they were friends, that he installed video surveillance. Nothing to do what the government needs to do, which is to show that Mr. Aquin was a part of this conspiracy, knew about the conspiracy, and voluntarily tied himself to it. This is simply a case in which the government...
And there's not enough evidence for the jury to believe that he knew that he was installing those lights for the purpose of protecting the drug trafficking business.
That's correct, Your Honor. Based on the testimony of the government's own witness, Mr. Perez, who said, Mr. Perez, who is part of that conspiracy, who's testifying to try to get a reduced sentence to try to help the government, he says it was there to protect the family. If a co-conspirator of Mr. Basadula didn't know and testified under oath that it's not meant to further the conspiracy...
Was there any evidence there that it would protect his drug business as well, or protect him from the violence that accompanies drug business?
The only evidence that was offered by the government in that regard was testimony by the case agent himself. There was no independent evidence, and they simply said it was there to protect the case agent. He testified that it was there based on his positioning to protect the...
His opinion.
In his opinion, correct. But there was no evidence that was shown to the jury to show them the cameras, how they were positioned. And again, Mr. Perez, a government witness, said it's there to protect the family. So there's nothing to show that jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Mr. Perez didn't know it was there for the drug activity. How could Mr. Aquin know? and the government failed to prove that.
What was the evidence with respect to his making bail or trying to make bail to get him out so that he could further engage in drug trafficking? What was the evidence surrounding that?
The evidence of that was for Ms. Maturin, who testified that she went over to the house to collect money, which, as I argue in the brief, is nothing more than saying that you would go to any creditor and say, hey, listen, you owe this man money. We need to get him out of jail. Give it to us. There was no testimony that Mr. Ackman said.
What is the evidence that to get him out of jail knew he was going back into the drug business immediately? Is there any specific evidence on that?
To the best of my recollection, there is no such evidence. The only evidence was Ms. Maturin's testimony that she went over to get money, but nothing that would tie the purpose of that money or that Mr. Ackman knew what the purpose of receiving that money was for.
Okay, Mr. Harville, thank you very much. You've saved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Stanford.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Stanford. I represent Masai Shandakam. Our argument is pretty simple. Her involvement in the conspiracy is tied to her having rented a townhouse. The evidence is pretty consistent that she did rent a townhouse. The evidence is also consistent that she was a drug addict, a methamphetamine addict. Sometime in October, Mr. Zafalom, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, I'll just call him Mr. X, who was a cousin of Ms. Shandakam, asked if she wouldn't mind Mr. Basil Duda spending 2 to 3 days a week at her townhouse, him and his girlfriend. Her belief was that he was from out of town. She said yes. Mr. Basil Duda, from time to time, paid her in small amounts of methamphetamine because she was a meth addict, and she did purchase additionally small amounts of methamphetamines from Mr. Basil Duda, usually a quarter gram at a time. And this information was made known when Ms. Shandakam agreed to cooperate with the FBI agents, sat down with them.
She did sell some, though, right?
She sold, I think she said she sold small amounts.
She sold small amounts, and the drugs that she sold came from this conspiracy.
Came from Mr. Basil Duda, correct.
Yeah,
okay. My point, Judge, is that there was no evidence to show that Ms. Shandakam, number one, yet she believed Mr. Basil Duda dealt drugs. She was suspicious of that fact when at one point she located a scale in the apartment, and the evidence in this case shows that she told him, don't sell drugs from my townhouse. So I think she was aware that he was a drug dealer. To what extent, there was no evidence to show. And if you look at the facts, she only purchased very small amounts from him, so she had no knowledge, and there's no evidence to suggest that she was aware that there was a conspiracy going on. When she did purchase or received small amounts of methamphetamines from Mr. Basil Duda, it was for her use, and she also admitted she shared some with her friends or sold small amounts to friends for use, as they referred to as partying, just personal use. The townhouse issue, the government didn't put on any evidence to show that she devised, managed, controlled, conducted, or participated in an illegal scheme for profit involving the procurement, transportation, or distribution of meth. The only evidence was that she purchased small amounts of meth from Mr. Basil Duda for personal use and that she was a methamphetamine addict. Mr. Basil Duda eventually...
Why did she think he was staying in her apartment intermittently with his girlfriend?
I'm not sure why he was. I think you could draw an inference that he
knew he was a drug dealer. She had that piece. She bought drugs from him.
Right. There was no evidence to show that she was allowing him to stay there to avoid detection by law enforcement. Obviously, none of the people there believed or knew that there was any surveillance being conducted. Otherwise, they would have, I'm sure, taken other actions. And I think basically she was allowing him to stay there so that she could receive small amounts of methamphetamine to feed her habit. Because, I mean, the evidence is uncontroverted that she was a meth addict, which is a terrible addiction.
If I own a home and I am involved in transporting an illegal alien every now and then, and I know someone comes to my house and stays every few weeks. He transports illegal aliens. Am I involved in his conspiracy?
Under that scenario, you could be, if you allow them to use your house to harbor illegal aliens from detection. That would be a violation of the harboring statute. But in this case, if you're looking at what Ms. Shondacom's knowledge was, she only knew that he had drugs because she bought small amounts from him.
Inside her own home?
Inside her home. There was no evidence to suggest or to show that she was aware that there was any kind of conspiracy going on, nor was there any evidence to show that she did anything in furtherance other than allowing Mr. Basaluta to stay at her apartment or at her townhouse from time to time in exchange for small amounts of meth. She wasn't out there selling for Mr. Basaluta. She wasn't making any contacts for him. She just let him stay there. And the evidence does show that in January, when she was arrested for writing bad checks, Mr. Basaluta bonded her out with the agreement that you move out of the townhouse, and me and my girlfriend are going to assume it.
Why was that? That was never clear in the briefs. Why did he want her out of the townhouse?
I'm not sure, Judge. What it shows to me, is that obviously she's not part of anything he's got going on, and he wants Ms. Shondacom out of the picture. Why? She's a meth addict. None of the other co-defendants were drug addicts. And I think that's a significant point in this case, that none of the co-defendants are drug addicts except for Mr. Shondacom. And Mr. Basaluta, recognizing that she's a drug addict, is using that to facilitate whatever he's going, unknown to Ms. Shondacom. Trial counsel for Ms. Shondacom filed a motion to sever. Of all the evidence that was introduced at trial, the overwhelming amount of evidence had nothing to do with Ms. Shondacom, but with the other co-defendants. And she was in the position of having to sit through a trial where basically the only evidence presented against her was basically her own statements to the FBI agents that she let him stay at the apartment. She was a meth addict. She purchased small amounts of meth for personal use, and that was it. The other thing we raise is excessive sentencing. Her guideline range was 24 to 30 months. The amount of meth that was introduced as relevant conduct was under, I think, 10 grams or around 10 grams, which is indicative of personal use and corroborates her statements that she was a meth user and that was it. We think that the sentence, although appropriate, is excessive because her guideline range was 24 to 30 months. And here, Ms. Shondacom, who is a minor participant and has, at best, a peripheral role, will be sitting in jail for 10 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Mrs. Dominguez.
May it please the Court, I'm Camille Domang, and I represent the United States, who's the appellee in this matter. I'll address...
How do you pronounce your name?
Domang.
Domang?
Domang.
Domang.
Yeah, I can't complain about any of the defendants' names in this case, because mine is almost as bad.
I know you're here very often, and I always look at that name and think, anyway, go ahead. Domang.
Unless the Court suggests otherwise, I'll address the issues raised by defense counsel in the order in which they're raised and rely on my brief for those arguments that were not specifically addressed
Whenever you have time, I would like your best cases on constructive amendment of the indictments with respect to Mr. Aquin and Zaffalon.
Sure. I'll go ahead and take that now. Aquin's argument is a little bit different than Zaffalon's argument. Aquin's argument is that when the United States proved overt acts that weren't specifically alleged in the indictment, that was a constructive amendment of the indictment. And the law of this circuit is fairly clear that the government always has the right to prove overt acts that aren't specifically alleged in the indictment. I would say especially in a drug case where the government doesn't even have...
Inside a case, I just need your best case on that.
I would say the Colum case was a case in which the district court was reversed for excluding evidence of uncharged overt acts in a conspiracy case. And Colum, I believe, cites Jackson. That's on the Oquan constructive amendment argument, which, as I said, relates to this unalleged overt acts. The Zappalam argument is a variance argument, which is a little bit different than that. Basically, Mr. Zappalam is saying the government alleged one indictment and actually proved two. And that was going to be my first argument, so I'll kind of backtrack and go there. It's the government's position that the evidence at trial, viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, and that's an important point because most of the defendant's arguments in this respect are sort of premised or the prelude to it is, well, there was evidence, but it was this co-conspirator evidence, and, you know, that's not very reliable. Well, when we review these issues on appeal, of course, we view them in the light most favorable to the verdict. So if there is some evidence, even if it's from a person that the jury could have chosen to disbelieve, then that's going to support a finding of a single conspiracy. It's the government's position that the evidence did support one versus multiple conspiracies in this case. That was a conspiracy that would have been started by Mr. Zappalam, the indictment alleges, in 2001, but we know it's no later than 2002 when he was found with a lot of methamphetamine in his backyard and a sort of makeshift methamphetamine lab bubbling away in the shed behind his yard. We know at that time that at least one of the individuals with whom he had conspired was this man, Eng Cham Kung Singh, who I'll refer to here and after just by his first name, Eng, for obvious reasons, and that he was an individual who distributed for Mr. Zappalam. So back in 2002, we had Eng distributing for Zappalam. When Mr. Zappalam is incarcerated based on the charges when the police find all the methamphetamine in his backyard, he goes to prison. He quits physically distributing methamphetamine because he's in prison. But as Judge Jolly pointed out, he doesn't abandon the conspiracy, the goals of the conspiracy, his conspiratorial intent. He tells Fanut Fanchenda, who I'll call Fanut, that he has a 5-year plan that's been interrupted, and he's going to continue his 5-year plan, as the judge pointed out, with the 19 dragons distributing methamphetamine, monopolizing the methamphetamine market in the New Iberia, Louisiana area once he gets out of jail. Mr. Aberle points out that the testimony of Mr. Fanchenda is, may be ambiguous. You can read it, he says. And what was he going to do after that? Go back to dealing meth. And then later he says, no, he didn't tell me that. That's up for the jury to resolve. I mean, testimony is, you know, notoriously in some cases ambiguous and contradictory, and of course the jury is allowed to pick and choose, construe inferences however it may wish to do so. So you've got Mr. Zappalam in prison. He talks about his 5-year plan, and while he is in prison, he is actively, he doesn't merely just have this idea. He is continuing to cultivate the plan for this, the continuation of his drug trafficking conspiracy. He keeps in touch with Eng. He calls him from prison and tells him he's met this individual, Basil Dua, and that's like a prospective associate. Travis Joseph testified that he overheard open conversations between Zappalam and Basil Dua in prison about their future drug plans. There's really no question that they're continuing to foster this plan. Basil Dua is taking the idea and running with it because, separate from Zappalam, Basil Dua, in recorded telephone conversations, is talking to an L.A. supplier. He's talking to his drug associates, and so they're really working on this plan while they're in prison. And this circuit recognized in the Davis case that the mere fact of an arrest does not terminate a conspiracy as long as the individuals keep working towards the conspiracy while they're in prison. And I would suggest to the court that that's exactly what we have here. Again, the defense counsel points out that the 2002 activity was the manufacturing of meth. The Basil Dua continuation of the conspiracy was a little bit different. There's no requirement that it have to be exactly the same. I would suggest to you it was a lot easier to manufacture methamphetamine in 2002 when the DEA wasn't so controlled on buying the cold medicine. And then, of course, as time goes on, then maybe it makes more sense to cultivate an L.A. connection, and that's what Basil Dua brought to the equation. He was a member of an L.A. gang, and he had the L.A. connection. There's a case cited in my brief that talks about what the different participants of the conspiracy bring to the equation, how they help each other. And that certainly happened in this case. And then the last point I make in my brief that I'll emphasize that really ties what happened in 2002 together with what happened later, meaning Zafalam and Basil Dua, and this is sort of in direct response to what Mr. Aberle said about no real evidence of a connection. These two were tangled up in all kinds of different ways. I mean, you've got Mise, who is the cousin of Zafalam. She's the one who later allows Basil Dua to stay at her house at Zafalam's request. Zafalam and Basil Dua date and live with sisters. This individual, Fanut Fonsinda, is the one who at one time lives with Zafalam's girlfriend, introduces Zafalam to the girlfriend, and then later becomes a distributor, a customer and distributor for both Zafalam and Basil Dua. So you really do have a lot of overlapping connections between the two. This is one ongoing conspiracy started by Zafalam, continued when Basil Dua and others join it. There's no requirement in the law of this or any circuit that every conspirator has to be in the mix from the very beginning until the very end. You can constantly add people and, you know, slightly change the objective, slightly change the modus operandi, and that's exactly what happened in this case. Now, alternatively, the law of the circuit, specifically the Mitchell case, says that even if the government charges one conspiracy and proves two, there's no effect on substantial rights as long as there is substantial evidence of the defendant's participation in at least one of the conspiracies. And we absolutely have that here. There's no question he was involved in the 2002 activity. That happened in his backyard, literally. And there's no question, based on the standard review, most favorable light to the verdict, that he was involved in the activity once Basil Dua got involved. The only question that the defendant raises is this issue of whether the two could have been joined in the same indictment. And we suggest that they could. Again, it's the statute of limitations problem is not an issue because it is continuing activity. And even if it's not, you don't toll the running of the statute of limitations clock when he's arrested because, again, the activity continues to go on, the five-year plan, and, you know, communicating with his distributor, Eng, who's on the outside.
You mentioned some activity that occurred while they were in jail. Did they make phone calls or anything that continued the conspiracy while there was some activity while they were in prison?
Absolutely. There is ample evidence that Basil Dua was working this hard when he was in jail. There were monitored prison phone calls where Basil Dua is reaching out to particularly Duck Pham, who is the L.A. Source. He's a co-gang member in L.A. He's the source of the methamphetamine.
Who first had the contact with Pham in L.A.?
Absolutely. Basil Dua.
Who did?
Basil Dua. Pham is Basil Dua's associate. That's one of the things that Basil Dua brings to the equation. He's got Pham. Judge Jolly, you asked if Doug Pham ever came to Louisiana, and I would suggest that the record indicates he did. A witness named Karen Martin testified that Doug Pham did come to Louisiana. She testified, in fact, that she believed she saw him at the townhouse where Basil Dua would intermittently stay at Mise's house. So I suggest that the record does indicate, to answer your question, that Mr. Pham did eventually come to Louisiana, probably towards the latter part. And then, of course, at some point, the informant goes out to L.A., and there's a control transaction that takes place in L.A., all of which was set up from this particular district. All right, I'll address quickly FAM's argument. Judge Jolly, as you intimated, it's the government's position that this issue is clearly controlled by this circuit's by Booker, and then by this circuit's post-Booker case law, specifically Mares. There's a Fifth Circuit case directly on point that upheld the application of that gun enhancement under Section 2D based on fact-finding under the preponderance standard by the court in light of the fact that the guidelines are no longer mandatory. You know, the idea that Booker both created and solved a constitutional infirmity in the guidelines. So as long as the guidelines aren't mandatory, fact-finding by the court is permissible. I'll move now to the arguments raised or the argument addressed today by counsel for Mr. Okwan, specifically on the idea of the sufficiency of the evidence. And basically, his argument is that his confession is not adequately corroborated. And there's a lot of case law in this and other circuits about the extent to which a confession has to be corroborated. And it is well settled that the government doesn't have to corroborate each and every element of the offense, that it's possible to prove entire elements of the offense by the confession itself without independent evidence. That really all we want to do is make sure the defendant isn't confessing to a fictitious crime. And the cases I cite in my brief, DeVille and Sterling discuss, you know, the fact that you can prove entire elements of an offense by the confession alone. And basically, we would suggest that one, the confession constitutes, or the elements of the confession establish Mr. Okwan's participation in the conspiracy, and that confession is sufficiently corroborated under the requirements in this circuit. There was Mr. Okwan confessed that he bought methamphetamine on a regular basis from the conspiracy and that he sold some of it. That's an important component. He confessed that he installed surveillance cameras at the Henry Street address in exchange for a quantity of marijuana. That's significant. The case I cite in my brief is Keller, that talks about acts that tend to conceal the existence of the conspiracy, to avoid police detection, are acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. We know that there's ample testimony that Arthur Basildua was extremely paranoid as a result of his own habitual use of methamphetamine. He was a methamphetamine addict. The testimony at trial was that he likely used it every day. And as a result of that, he was extremely paranoid. Defense counsel points to you know, one little part of Israel Perez's testimony that talks about, well, you know, I think he was asked on cross-examination, what were the surveillance cameras for? And Mr. Perez volunteered, well, maybe to protect the children. Well, the problem with that is, you know,
did he say maybe protect the children?
I'm not sure if he used the word maybe, Your Honor. He said something about because the children were there. But the fact is, the children were not there the entire time. Basildua and Zafalam moved into that house on Henry Street in June. The children are not Basildua's children. They are the children of the girlfriend, Melissa Maturin. Melissa Maturin testified that she thinks they moved into the house in Henry Street in October. So you have some period of time when the children weren't even there.
Okay, but what evidence do you have that it was specifically for the purpose of protecting the drug trade?
I'm not sure that any witness ever testified that the cameras were there to protect the drug trade.
So what evidence are you relying on?
I think it's a reasonable inference that the jury can reach, that Basildua is exceedingly paranoid. He's worried about the FBI.
And how do you know that what is the evidence that he was paranoid?
Several witnesses testified to that, Your Honor. Several witnesses testified to his habitual use. There were witnesses, for example.
Well, what about his paranoia? In other
words, no, there were witnesses, and I'm trying to think if it was probably Karen Martin. There were three sisters, one day to Zafalam, one day to Basildua, and the other one, according to her testimony, didn't like any of that. But she testified that on occasion when she would go over to Basildua's house, he would make her empty her purse, and he would search her, or she felt like he was going to search her to make sure she wasn't wearing a wire. The confidential informant testified that during one of the controlled buys, he chose not to wear a wire because Basildua was so paranoid.
But that connects to Aquin.
Pardon me?
How does that connect to Aucoin?
Well, the judge's question was, where does the jury infer that the surveillance cameras were related to paranoia?
Aucoin's got to know that, not just the jury. You've got to connect it up to Aucoin.
Well, Your Honor, I think it is part and parcel of the same thing, that Aucoin knows Basil Dewey is a drug dealer because he buys from him. He knows it.
Now, is there any evidence, though, that they were threatened by competitors or anyone else, or by were law enforcement officials on them at that time, or was there any evidence that there was a specific need for this surveillance at that time that they were installed?
I can tell you that at the time.
The answer is no, right?
Well, I'll answer it this way. The FBI was conducting surveillance. Now, whether Basil Dewey saw a car, saw an agent, I don't think the record reflects that that was the case.
Sounds pretty thin to me.
But the FBI was conducting surveillance at the time. And,
Now what else are you relying on for Aucoin then? If we think you've overdone it a little bit on the surveillance lights, what other evidence are you relying on to connect him to the conspiracy?
Well, you do have this issue of when Basil Dewey gets in trouble, when he's arrested in a traffic stop, and he's found with a gun and 121 grams of methamphetamine, and he goes to jail. When he goes to jail, he reaches out to Melissa Maturin, his girlfriend, and says, "We need to raise some bail money. Go call our people and raise some bail money."
Say all of that again now, how Aucoin is involved in this. Was Aucoin in jail?
No. Aucoin was initially in jail. That's how he met Basil Dewey. He was in jail on a drug offense. Basil Dewey, Zappalum,
all right, but
that's how they all met.
But Aucoin's earlier drug offenses are not alleged as part of this conspiracy.
The offense that got him in jail the first time is not part of this conspiracy.
So that's not part of it.
No.
So, what are we dealing with now?
So later on, Aucoin's out of jail.
Uh-huh.
Basil Dewey is arrested after a traffic stop in the car with Israel Perez. They find 121 grams of meth and a gun and a scale, I think. And Basil Dewey goes to jail, and he wants to get out of jail. The one thing that is...
We don't have Aucoin connected with him up until this point, right?
When you say connected, Judge, I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I mean, we don't have any association between
yes.
him and Aucoin.
Yes, this is when, before all this, this happens at the end of the conspiracy. That's like the second to last thing that happens in the conspiracy, the last thing being Basil Dewey shooting the bondsman. But so before that traffic stop happens, that's when you have the surveillance cameras installed. That's when you have Aucoin buying on a regular basis from Basil Dewey. So you clearly have a connection.
So he knows Basil Dewey is a drug dealer.
Undoubtedly.
Deal.
Absolutely. And when there's a problem with the surveillance cameras, they call Aucoin out to the house. Israel Perez testified to that, to fix the cameras.
I mean, aren't you almost getting to the point that anybody that does any work on his house or on his property is all of a sudden drawn into the conspiracy?
We're not just relying on the installation of the surveillance cameras. One, it was surveillance cameras in exchange for methamphetamine. The payment was in meth. This is his supplier. He's installing surveillance cameras on the home of his supplier.
You've got to show that he understood that the surveillance cameras were somehow connected to protect the drug trade or connected with the drugs.
Judge, again, our position is that this is something that the jury can infer. There's testimony from the agent that while this is not the highest crime...
Why can we think the jury would infer that when the specific testimony is that was to protect children?
But again, Judge, there's a gap there. The children don't arrive until October. Basil Dewey and Zaphalam are in that house dealing drugs in June.
But
so
when was the installation made?
The record's not clear. I will tell you, the record's not. It doesn't give you an exact day. Well, but what I'm saying is, when Israel Perez testifies that the cameras were there to install to protect it because there were children there, he wasn't there from the beginning. So there was a time when the cameras could have been there to protect the drug trafficking enterprise.
So if we reject that, the camera business, We're left with the fact that he's raising money to get him out of jail. Is that it?
He is, and telephone tolls. In a 60-day period, there are 108 telephone calls between Oquan and Basil Dua. And that's not a frequency that you would see with someone who
Over how long a period of time?
60 days, I believe, Your Honor. Okay. 108 calls. I think I'll stand corrected on the numbers, but I'm pretty sure it's 108 calls in 60 days.
Something was really bad wrong with those lights.
Well, it could be, Judge, that there was a problem. But I would suggest, you know, there's Fifth Circuit case law that says that the jury can make inferences based on frequencies of calls. And
so what did Oquan then say in his confession?
Oquan said that he met Basil Dua and Zafalon in prison, that he bought from them regularly, that he would sell some and use some, that he installed surveillance cameras on the house in exchange for an 8-ball of methamphetamine, and that after Basil Dua was arrested the last time, he tried to raise some bail money for Basil Dua by selling some, I think he said amplifiers. I think that's what the record reflects. He claimed he sold some amplifiers in order to raise bail money.
Now, where did the shooting of the bail's bondsman come into that?
That happens at the very end, Your Honor. This investigation was cut short because of that. The FBI had intended, and this is reflected in the record.
Killed the bail's bondsman?
No. They were very seriously injured, though. There were two bail bondsmen. It was a very heinous and brutal shooting. He just stood over them and kept shooting at them. And that's when... That gives rise to the events that surround the giving of Mr. Oquan's statement. The FBI agents and every local police officer is combing the countryside for Basil Dua. They go to Oquan's house, and that's what led to Oquan's
eventual... But raising bail bond money by selling an amp, that's not illegal, number one.
No, it's not, Your Honor, except that...
My mother might go sell something to bail me out of jail. That does not mean that she's involved in the conspiracy that I was involved in.
No, it's not, except that when we look at what do co-conspirators do? They do things to further the conspiracy. If you're arrested on some unrelated thing and your mother sells a ring to get you out of jail, that's one thing. But, you know, is your mother also storing your stolen goods? Is she also, you know, doing other things for you? And I would just suggest in this case, it's a part of the puzzle. And you know, again, the jury can infer that this was not just a good Samaritan trying to raise a little bit of money for him out of the goodness of his heart. There is ample evidence in this record that bail meant nothing to Basil Dua. And he repeatedly got out on bail, and this is all he did. In fact, a witness was specifically asked, did he have an actual job? Did he do anything else? And the answer was no. This is all he did. So every time he got out on bail, he would go back to selling drugs. And Judge, I think as you intimated in one of your questions.
Wait, who are we talking about now?
Basil Dua.
But we're talking about Oquan now. Oquan, did he have a job?
Oquan, yes. I believe he had some sort of employment.
Okay.
I believe he did. I believe he did have another job. I mean, and he's not the scale of drug dealer that Basil Dua and Zafalon are. I mean, there's no question.
Oquan did have a drug record, though, didn't he?
He did. He did. He had a criminal record. Again,
did
that's
he testify on his own behalf?
He did not, Your Honor. He did not. He did not. All right. I will move on to the issues raised by Mise Chandankam. You know, basically her argument is she was a user and an addict, and she didn't actually participate in the conspiracy. She couldn't foresee or couldn't imagine or understand that there was anything beyond just her buying small amounts of methamphetamine from Basil Dua. One of the more significant things that she does. Well, first of all, you know, she admits that she knows Basil Dua is a drug dealer. Obviously, she buys from him. She buys from him on a fairly regular basis. She admitted that she sold some of the drugs that she would buy to other individuals. She introduced someone who later became a customer, someone referred to in the record by the name Woodman, I think because, according to the testimony, he was a carpenter. So,
well, now, what was she charged with? Was she charged in substantive counts as well as the only conspiracy?
Just the conspiracy, Your Honor.
Okay, and what was the evidence that tied her sales of meth were to this conspiracy.
Well, the
in other words, they were given to her as a compensation. Then she goes off outside the conspiracy and sells it to individuals to make money for herself, completely apart from the conspiracy. There's no evidence she shared the money with the conspiracy.
I don't think it's required, Your Honor. I think
I
going
that, but I mean, just think that she may be disassociated from the conspiracy and all of the sales that she may have engaged in.
Where she's not disassociated with the conspiracy.
Tell me how her sales relate to this conspiracy.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. She buys from Basil Dua. Some of it
If you've got a conspiracy, I mean, you think everybody is working together, and the goal of that conspiracy and the single purpose of that conspiracy is to distribute and sell drugs mutually, and you have a mutual relationship, and it looks like that she may have been off on her own.
Well,
away from the conspiracy.
If the only thing
I heard of her drug sales to the conspiracy.
Well, Judge, if the only thing she brought to the table was that she was a distributor, then that might be an issue. I will tell you, I don't think the record reflects that she ever took, you know, if she sold, $100 worth of meth, that she gave $50 back to Basil Dua. I don't think you're going to find that in this record. But she brings something else to the table, and that's the safe haven, the townhouse on Eros Landry Road in Lafayette. Basil Dua is living in New Iberia. He's extremely paranoid, so much so that he goes to Zathalam and says, apparently they talk about it, because Zathalam, who is Mise Shandankam's cousin, calls her and says, will you let Basil Dua stay at your apartment a few days a week?
Does she know Zathalam's involved in the drug dealing?
I'm trying to remember, Judge, if she said so in her confession. It would have had to have been in her confession. I don't believe she confessed as much. But they are cousins. Zathalam had been in the drug business for years, and he had been in prison for drug dealing before. So again, that might be an inference that the jury could make. But
did
she
have a romantic relationship with him?
Who? Basil Dua and Mise?
Right.
The record does not reflect that. It could be, Your Honor, but it's not in the record.
Okay.
So Zathalam says, will you let Basil Dua stay at your apartment intermittently? And she says yes. And she admits that she knows Basil Dua is a drug dealer. She knows that Basil Dua is selling drugs out of her house. She's getting drugs from him. And the record reflects that the safe haven she provided them, this townhouse on Eros Landry, that it worked. Because the FBI case agent testified that they had Basil Dua under surveillance on Henry Street for a significant amount of time, and then they lost him. And the time when they lost him was when he was staying intermittently at Chandankam's townhouse, and then eventually permanently at her townhouse. I think Judge Jolly, or maybe Judge Owen, you asked why did they want her out of there. I would suggest to you it was a space problem. I think there's testimony in the record by Israel Perez that when he got to the townhouse, he didn't know it was going to be so crowded. There are pictures of the townhouse in the record. It's a small place. And you had Basil Dua, his girlfriend Melissa Maturin, and she had two children, I believe like preteen, teenage children, plus Basil Dua, plus Mise, plus Israel. I would suggest that the jury could have inferred it wasn't to keep her in the dark, because she wasn't in the dark.
Was she romantically involved with Israel Perez?
I do not, the record doesn't indicate. She could well have been. She did complain to him that Zathalam and Basil Dua weren't doing their part for her. They weren't giving her pocket money. They weren't giving her spending money so that she could buy herself a car or buy herself things. So, she would cry to Israel Perez. They did have some sort of a relationship. The record doesn't reflect that it was a romantic or a sexual relationship.
Okay, Ms. Bang, thank you for your usual spirited argument. Mr. Avery.
Understandably, she keeps accusing my client of being a big drug dealer. But Ms. Chandakam said that my client didn't deal drugs with Mr. Basulda. Melissa Maturin said my client was not involved in this. There is only one witness who ever said that he actually saw my client selling drugs, and that was this peanut guy, Fanchunda, which is also asserted as the connection between the 2002 and the current conspiracy. And as you asked about this conversation, when he is testifying, Mr. Fanchunda, about him being in jail with my client, he reveals that he met him before he went to jail, and the conversation about the 19 Dragons is premised with the following question. Oh, you met him outside of jail as well. A few lines down, did he tell you he planned to be in the business? He said he was going to plan for about 5 years. Now, the next thing he says is 4 years, and he never made it to five or something like that. Now, is that my client talking to him, or is that his conclusion? Well, at the end, he's asked, did he indicate to you when he got arrested, did he indicate to you what he was going to do once he got out? No. No, sir. It's his testimony. I think you have to rely on it. And again, Mr. Zaffalam sat in that jail for 2.5 years, not talking to anybody or anyone. That severs the connection, if there is one, between these two conspiracies. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Haberle. And you were court-appointed, I believe, and the court certainly appreciates the fine service you've rendered to the court and your client. Okay. Yes, Ms. Odenay.
Two issues, Your Honor. First thing, you'd asked if Mr. Pham had come to Louisiana. I apologize. If the record reflects that he did, then certainly that's what the record reflects, and I apologize for any misstatement suggesting otherwise. But the basis of our appeal, the heart of our appeal, is for actions or an occurrence that occurred in California, nothing that occurred here in Louisiana. We're not contesting the application of a statute, but rather we're getting to the point where the statute is even an issue. We're contesting a factual finding by the court, not the trier fact, but by the court, that Duck Pham was guilty of a crime that he was never charged with. And that's where the basis of our appeal comes in.
Okay, Ms. Odenay, and you were court-appointed as well, and the court would like to express its appreciation to you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Harville?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, the government's problem is this. It has to argue inference versus evidence, what the jury could have inferred. However, to corroborate Mr. Aquin's confession, it needed substantial evidence that showed it was trustworthy. It does not have that. There's talk about, in his confession, he said he was sold an amplifier. Ms. Maturin, who went to collect the money, says it was tire rims and it was given before. Nothing to substantiate, again, what he said during the confession. The government failed to prove that the confession is trustworthy with substantial evidence. This is a man, again, Mr. Perez. Mr. Aquin says, I was paid in drugs to install the camera. Mr. Perez, a government witness, says, no, he was paid in cash. The unrecorded confession by Mr. Aquin is not corroborated by the government. In fact, it's proven untrustworthy. The government can argue inferences all it wants to, but it can't do what it needs to, which is show Your Honors the evidence which support that confession, because there is none. You would ask, there was a question as to whether or not Mr. Aquin was employed. There was stipulation by the government, Mr. Aquin, he made $300 a day, 21 days a month, from October 2006 to December 2007. He received $1.50 per mile for travel allowance. Mr. Aquin was someone who had a job. The government failed to prove that he confessed in a trustworthy manner that he was involved in this conspiracy. There's but one thing to do, and that's to enter a judgment of acquittal on his behalf. You have an exceedingly paranoid drug dealer who had children. Mr. Perez's testimony is believable. Cameras were put in to protect the children. No evidence by the government to prove that the cameras had any other purpose toward furthering the conspiracy, or more importantly, that Mr. Aquin had knowledge of the conspiracy and voluntarily joined it. There's just no evidence that the government offered to substantiate that portion of his confession, and for that reason, he should have been acquitted. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, Mr. Harville, you were also court-appointed, and the court would certainly like to express its appreciation for the good job that you've done for your client and the service you've rendered to the court. So that concludes this case, and Mr. Stanford, you didn't save any time for rebuttal, I believe. So that concludes the arguments in this case, and that concludes the oral arguments that are before this panel today and for the week. So this panel stands adjourned.